at least part of the dictionary between the topics that have been reviewed in the previous two talks, and to discuss how vertex algebras can be used to do some concrete calculations in this context. So I will focus on the quantum version of geometric Langlands. It's some paradoxically a little bit easier to deal with in many ways. So to be specific, this is somewhat a deformation of the statement that we saw at the beginning, that we saw at the last talk. It involves some twisted version of the modules on the space of G bundles. And now twist the modules with an opposite twist, somehow, with an inverse twist. On bundles for the dual group. But these bundles are understood on some Riemann surface, C. Which for now I'm equipping with a spin structure. So as far as I understand, this statement has to be modified a bit if you want to be able to ignore the choice of spin structure. So if you want to try to compare with the previous statement, so as Edward was reviewing, the standard geometric Langland arises at in gauge theory at psi equal to infinity or zero. Now, psi is just the same as kappa for the rest of the talk. So this is a statement that occurs for generic value of psi. As psi goes to infinity, this twisting goes away, you just get the modules. On the other hand, here you get some kind of an infinitely twisted the modules. And one can try to argue that they go to coherent shifts. So I'm not sure the argument is very transparent to me. In physics, it happens because when you study certain boundary conditions, like Dirichlet boundary conditions, they can be coupled to a background connection. So in Dirichlet boundary conditions, you set the connections to some fixed values at the boundary. Now, sometimes your theory might depend on these specific values. Sometimes they depend on these values only up to some, sometimes you might lose some information. For generic psi, you only remember the bundle defined by the connection you put at the boundary. At psi equal to infinity, you remember the full flat connection. And so somehow when you do calculations at generic psi, you end up with things that live on the space of bundles. But when you do calculations at psi equal to infinity, you get things that live on the space of flat connections. Okay, and sorry, I want to work with generic groups, so I should put an M here, which is the lacing number. So for simply laced, this would be 1. For non-simply laced, this could be 2 or 3. Okay, so also it was mentioned in the talk that one constraint you want to put on this functor is that maps certain objects on one side to certain objects on the other side. The quantum geometric Langland version of that, if the audience should correct me as soon as I get wrong, which has probably happened already, is that the D module of differential operators itself, perhaps modified at certain points, is mapped to some other D module, which is kind of a quantization of the upper manifold. Actually, let me just call it like that. And quantization of the upper manifold inside the space of flat connections, again, potentially modified at some points.
So on the left, you have D itself regarded as a D module?
That's right. And on the right, there is, D modules on band G are a way to describe Lagrangians, among other things, Lagrangians inside A-brains in the space of flat connections. in particular Lagrangians in the space of Lie connections. And there is a particularly nice Lagrangian, which is the upper manifold. And the quantization of the upper manifold is something, some D-module. Concretely, it's built by sort of pull back, push forward involving the nilpotent bundles with nilpotent structure group. Now, and I should also say that this several interesting objects and morphisms in this story are related to vertex algebras. For example, decay itself is the same as conformal blocks, or perhaps I should call it chiral cohomology, sort of derived conformal blocks of Katz-Moody. This is not immediately identified as conformal blocks or something, but on the other hand, taking homes with this is related to Dreyfus Solokov reduction. So for example, homes from BK to this op K gives you conformal blocks of the Dreyfus Solokov reduction of Katz-Moody, which is the W algebra. Now, if you look at this duality, you see the sort of the duality interchange would map D to op and op to D. And so it's a nice thing that the W algebra has something called Fagan-Frankel duality, which means that the W algebra associated to G is the same as the W algebra associated to D, to G dual. So there are some non-trivial facts about vertex algebras are intertwined with this story at many locations. Okay, so now I would like to describe a few, well, suggestions or that come from gauge theory about how to look at this setup. I think the most basic suggestion is that you should not look at this functor by itself. That this functor is part of a groupoid of functors, which, well, I should just say group, but groupoid is better, which interchanges a certain collection of categories which look like these, or modifications of this. But so let me do it a step at a time. The first step is that there is a nice line bundle on Van G, which is a clear physical interpretation. It's associated to the Chern-Simons theory. It's what appears in the description of Chern-Simons theory with the minimum possible level. So Chern-Simons theory for G at the minimum level, which I'll call N of G. So I just normalized the levels so that for the simply connected form of the group, the minimum level is 1 on a spin manifold. And okay, if you change the global form of the group, this number will change. And there are also subtle differences in working on spin manifold and non-spin manifolds, which is related to what I mentioned before. The fact that I'm working now with a Riemann surface with a spin structure. Okay, so this transformation, I call it S because it's supposed to be S duality of an echo force of Mills. Tau goes to 1 over m tau. Another generator of the duality group is tau goes to tau plus 1, or more precisely, tau goes to tau plus ng. So there should be a functor, right, which corresponds to doing this operation t to the ng. And from the gauge theory description of T, it's quite clear that the functor must look like this. Actually, write it like that. So it goes from the K mod, from the modules with twist K, to the modules we twist k plus n of g. And it takes some D module, and it just tensors it with this line bundle. Okay, so I probably should have mentioned what the twist of a D module is, but roughly, twisted D modules are things which are acted by differential operators in the same way as differential operators would act on some fractional power of this fractional power kappa of this line bundle. So tensoring by this line bundle shifts kappa by some appropriate power, by some appropriate integer amount. So this is supposed to be T to the ng. Now the basic observation that comes, now the fact that this functor exists is of course very trivial. The fact that the non-trivial fact that comes from gauge theory is that S and T should satisfy the same relations as they satisfy in the duality group of gauge theory. In particular, if you write some matrices like this in G in PGL 2, see, and you define, you know, interesting functors by composing these two basic functors. You do things like, you know, I do T to some power of n of g, then I do S, then I do T to some power of n of g dual, and then I do S again, and then I do T to some power and S, and so on. I generate a very large family of functors, but if the all the functors for which I get the same matrix are the same. Now, unfortunately, for a typical gauge group where n g and n g dual are not equal to 1, the relations might be pretty ugly to write down. But if you work already with, if you work with a group like GLN or E8, where n g and n g dual are just 1, then you can get interesting mileage from the very basic relation that ST cubed is 1. This is already a very non-trivial statement. Another useful statement is that these guys are invariant under T. Somehow this tensors it, this tensor then by a line bundle, but somehow this line bundle is trivial on the support of this the modules. So you can do something fun. You can do say something like, okay, let me take D. D must be invariant under S, T, S, right? At least for this, for E8 or for GLN. Well, when I say invariant, I really mean D for DK should be mapped to D of S, T, S of k, so it's something like minus 1 over 1 plus 1 minus 1 over k. Okay. But STS is the same as T inverse S T inverse. So you learn that DK tensor L inverse should be mapped by S to D something tensor L. This, as far as I know, is a non-trivial statement. Now, if you try to do it for a generic group, this line bundle does not exist. But the statement is actually still true. It just it becomes a statement about some of this generalization of further generalization that I want to discuss next. But
can you just repeat what? So this D is a differential operator.
That's right. So I claim that. So actually, let me write it like that. So it's really. Okay.
Just trying to parse it. So first of all.
So I take DK plus 1. Tensor it at L inverse so that it lands in DK. mod.
As a D module.
As the D module.
Okay. Yeah.
Then it's in the correct category to apply the duality.
Right.
And I can predict that it will land on D of minus 1 over k minus 1 tensor with L.
That's on the dual side?
Yes, on the dual side.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So this might be true or might be false. If it's false, then quantum geometric Langlands does not have something to do with gauge theory. But
so, I mean, what's the step to use gauge theory and not just the SL2Z of quantum geometric Langlands?
Well, but I'm not aware that SL2Z of quantum geometric Langlands was a thing.
No?
Was it? I don't know. When people study quantum geometric Langlands, do they study SL2Z or do they study Z2?
SL2Z.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everything attacks there.
But the fact that it satisfies SL2Z relations, is it well understood?
Conjectural,
okay. Right. So this is an example of the consequences of that.
What the key step here was that the OPR manifold was invariant under T?
That's right. Now, I'm going to give the corresponding statement in terms of boundary conditions momentarily, but I can already say this represents Neumann boundary conditions. This represents NAM-pole boundary conditions. And NAM-pole boundary conditions are invariant under T. This represents the T image of Neumann boundary conditions, which are called 1, 1 boundary conditions, and which are mapped to the T inverse image under S duality. Another fun observation is that you can start taking homes between these objects and these. And then the equality of the two sides will become, will have again an interpretation in terms of vertex algebras. So it will be a statement about the coset construction of W algebras. So by considering this enlarged, yes?
One question. So this combination of S and T, is this supposed to be directly related to consequences of S-duality on the four-dimensional level than in three dimensions on the level of complex transformation theories that Mikhailov had recently discussed?
Yes, so right. So this, I guess the answer is yes.
Must somehow be yes.
Yes. No, and I...
The concrete consequences, I don't...
So I the way I'm going to present things is, first I want to say a few things about the quantum geometric Langlands, then about vertex algebras that justify some of these statements, and then how do you get these vertex algebras from gauge theory? Okay, so this is the first observation. But now you would like to be able to do something like this also for general gauge groups. But unfortunately, T is not a symmetry for a general gauge group. On the other hand, it turns out that SL2Z still acts in interesting ways on gauge theories. It's just that the image of a generic SL2Z transformation is not G gauge theory or G dual gauge theory. It's gauge theory for some other global form of G or of G dual, possibly dressed by a discrete theta angle. So the correct gauge theory story, which was described recently in papers like Reading Between the Lines by Cyber Garoni and others, is that you should really look in gauge theory to three pieces of data. You have the gauge group, you have the coupling, but you also have some discrete theta angle. And dualities act non-trivially on, so you have the group, but in some specific global form, you might have the dual group, again in some specific global form. And dualities are going to map you back and forth from this, between these objects. For example, if you look at SL2, So if you start from a SU2 gauge theory, this is invariant under T. It's mapped to itself after shift of K, of course, by T. But under S, so under S is mapped to SO3 gauge theory. Now, SO3 gauge theory is sent to itself by T, but not by T squared, at least on a spin manifold, but not by T. By T, if you act with T on SO3, you end up with some sort of variant of SO3, which has a discrete theta angle. And in sort of there is a background theta angle of 2 pi on top of the one that you put inside your coupling. So let me distinguish them as SO3 0 and SO3 1. And then this is invariant under S. Now, this is not a terribly interesting example, but you start getting more interesting examples if you look, say, at SU4. So if you look at SU4, SU4 is invariant under T. It's mapped by S to PSU4. Sort of standard. Then there are four variants of this, where you keep shifting the theta angle by 1/4 of the minimum amount. But interesting things start happening if you start doing S transformations of these other nodes. For example, these two are related by S. And this other one is mapped by S to SU4 mod Z2, or at least one of the variants. And then there is another variant of SU4 mod Z2, which is mapped to itself both by S and T. See, using the standard knowledge about the S operation, right, you could have surely gotten here and probably also here, essentially because doing T between these and these is the same as doing T, S, T on these, which is the same as S, T, S. And so goes there. Yes?
Is there something of this diagram to components of the Hitchin moduli space rather stuck?
I will mention that. Next.
That seemed to be labeled by slightly different data, namely E and L, right?
There is a long discussion there, and I will not give the whole discussion. There are also things that I myself don't fully understand, especially when you go to manifolds which are not spin. But I wanted to stress out that here you find SU4 mod Z2 now. This is really a different global form of the group. But you got here by doing standard dualities on SU4 and SU4 mod Z4. So this presumably is a new observation. When you go from this data to categorical data, essentially what's happening is that you can map these to a gerb. So you get some sort of gerb twisted decay mod. So the modules which are twisted by this gerb. Now there is a certain technology to go from to figure out what these diagrams look like. You can also find, I think, most of them in this paper by this reading between the lines of four-dimensional gauge theories. I could keep drawing them, they're actually quite fun. But essentially, for every choice of Lie algebra, the choice of global form and theta angles gives you some big collection, and then there are some huge duality orbits within each collection, sometimes disconnected. And if you want to, you know, working with this extended space has the advantage of now checking you can just check that ST cubed is 1 instead of trying to check some complicated relation for a finite index subgroup of SH2Z. Okay, so this is the first, the pure, sort of purely gauge theory statement. Now, another statement is that gauge theory suggests an algorithm, if you want, to do two things. One of the two things is to find the image of these under any of these dualities. So the statement is that if you take the image under these dualities of dk, this will always be, except in this case, the conformal blocks of some vertex algebra. So there will be some, so always be some vertex algebra which has some Kac-Moody currents inside, and which you can use to couple to bundle, so that conformal blocks can be studied as a function of a bundle. Another statement is that you can sort of consider the identity functor from dk ban g to at least. Let me say it better. There is a diagonal. If you consider ban G, the k of ban G times d minus k of ban G, you can find the diagonal inside here. Something, you know, sort of the something that looks should behave more or less at least like a conormal bundle to the diagonal. And so this is an object which has the property that if you convolve it in another object, it should give back the object itself. Now I'm hearing that there could be some problems with the next statement I'm going to make, but still let me try to make it. If you can try to apply duality to one of the two sides of this, so that you can get an object which now maps dk of ban g to the dual, so a kernel for the duality. So again, so you can take g acting on the first factor of this diagonal. And at least tentatively, you can again try to write it down as the conformal blocks of some other vertex algebra. A vertex algebra which now has two Kac-Moody currents inside, one for G and one for the dual group, and so it can give you an object inside the modules on the polar spaces of bundles. Okay, now these algebras are built in a certain systematic way, which can be discussed purely in the language of vertex algebras. You don't strictly need gauge theory to build vertex algebras. Although gauge theory will predict some properties of these vertex algebras, it might not have been immediately obvious. The basic idea to build these vertex algebras is to take a bunch of copies of Kac-Moody algebras and W algebras, take their product, and extend them to a bigger algebra in a systematic way. So to give a very basic example, take again your Kac-Moody algebra. Now, even when we use this algebra in physics, there is a natural set of local vertex operators for this algebra that we often employ, which are sort of modules where you take a finite dimensional representation of the algebra and you sort of extend it as a Weyl module, extend it. You say it's annihilated by the positive modes and the negative modes act freely. So we call those Weyl modules. And these Weyl modules form a certain category of modules, which is really called Kazan-Lustig, the Kazan-Lustig category. Now, to be specific, and then I can just look at representations of some global form of the group to get Kazan-Lustig for that global form of the group. Now, in the past, I would call this a ribbon category because these modules can be fused and braided across around each other. I understand that there are better ways to think about it as a chiral category where you think about the KZ equation satisfied by these modules rather than the monodromy. So it's like the difference between flat connection and local system. But anyway, I will not get in there because I don't know the definition. But a basic property is that, so if I was thinking about it as a braided category, as a ribbon category, when I braid these modules around each other, I get phases which look like e to the 2 pi I over k. Just to avoid confusion, when I write the level of the vertex algebra, I mean the level shifted by h. So in a standard conformal field theory textbook, this would be k plus h. Let me just call it k. So now this number does not change. It's 1 over k shifted by an integer. Right? So morally speaking, the Kazan-Lustig category for k plus n g is more or less the same as the Kazan-Lustig category of k, of k prime, if k 1 over k minus 1 over k prime is multiple of ng. Now, furthermore, the Kazan-Lustig category for k and the Kazan-Lustig category for k prime are sort of dual of each other if 1 over k plus 1 over k prime is a multiple of ng. So a consequence of this is that you can start from Kazan-Lustig, from Kazmoody for some level k times Kazmoody for the level k prime with k plus k prime equal 1 over k plus 1 over k prime equal to a multiple of this basic amount, and build a new category, which is a sum of modules, of products of modules for the two algebras. At least for generic kappa. I'm really working away from rational kappa where things become more subtle. Although I think the construction still works, but it's trickier. So somehow these modules braid, these modules are sort of paired up in such a way that when they can braid trivially around each other, the phases that this half acquires are cancelled exactly by the phases that this half acquires. This is very analogous to when you build modular invariants in a conformal field theory, except that usually you pair up a vertex algebra which is complex conjugate. Instead, here I'm pairing up a vertex algebra with another vertex holomorphic vertex algebra which braids in the opposite way. So this gives you a new vertex algebra, which has inside the product of two Kazmoodys. You can also use as an ingredient W algebras. W algebras have modules which are labeled by two weights, one for the group and one for the dual group. And so there is a functor from Kazan-Lustig of G times Kazan-Lustig of G dual into modules for the W algebra. And so again, you can do a construction where you attach together a W algebra and a Kazmoody. So roughly speaking, these algebras A end up looking as objects of this form. You take W algebra times W algebra times W algebra times Katz Moody. And these other algebras look like Katz Moody times W algebra times W algebra times W algebra times Katz Moody, extended in the way I described briefly. So at each step, you need to pick an integer. What you're doing is essentially building kernels for the thing that I had here and I erased, something that looks like Sm t to the n1n of g s t to the something, s t to the something, s t to something, etc. Now, when you build this vertex algebra, you typically want to try to stay in a world of good vertex algebras, meaning, you know, Katz Moody, W algebras, they all have operate currents of positive dimension. But, and you want to make sure that the new currents you add are also of positive dimension. And so if you want that to happen, then you need to take these numbers to be large enough, positive and large enough. Because the dimensions of the new things you're adding pretty much are controlled by this sum. Okay, so this was just to describe a general vertex algebra setup, which you can argue has a nice relation with quantum geometric Langlands. And now let me try to explain the gauge theory motivation for all of this. Maybe I should have gone the other way around, but I was afraid that starting with the gauge theory would lose too much of the audience.
Yeah, so what they say is that you can construct some vertex algebras. So how many vertex algebras can you construct this way? There will be a one-to-one correspondence with what?
Well, the first thing you could ask is that if this vertex algebra would satisfy the same relations as this sort of group duality transformations, the answer would typically be no. What should be true is that the conformal blocks of this algebra have the property. So for now, this really just builds a lot of vertex algebras, which
what does a lot of mean? So how many?
Well, as you're seeing, they're labeled by a bunch of integers, which is what you're using for the gluing at each step. Now, it turns out that for nice choices of numbers, a lot of these algebras are algebras you actually know in disguise. In a sense, this operation is the inverse of a coset. You know, when you have a coset, you take a bigger algebra and you subtract off a subalgebra and get something that commutes with that. This is sort of trying to reverse it. Okay, so now let me give a gauge theory motivation now for the structures that I've been discussing. So somehow the operations that you use in building these vertex algebras have a natural interpretation of the level of conformal blocks. They correspond to so if you can ask what are the conformal blocks of one of these vertex algebras in terms of the conformal blocks of the smaller vertex algebras. And as far as I can see, a lot of these operations are natural operations in these categories. So let me try to give some physical motivation to things. So Edward mentioned that there are something called boundary conditions for four-dimensional gauge theory. So there is a four-dimensional TFT. Okay. This four-dimensional TFT has three-dimensional topological boundary conditions And but it does not have many topological junctions between boundary conditions.
In other words, corners in language.
Corners, that's right. Instead, you have a lot of holomorphic corners. Which means that if you start looking at the local operators available in this setup, here you have very few local operators of dimension zero, which whose correlation functions are independent of the position. But here you have local operators which depend holomorphically on the position. So this support vertex algebras of local operators. Okay. So the picture that you should have is that you have some three-dimensional boundary, which I'll draw as two-dimensional. Some other two-dimensional boundary. And they can meet along the 2D junction. Now, I draw them as perpendicular, but they can have any angle you want between them. So in the setup that we are interested in, this direction which is common along which the junction extends will be the curve. On the other hand, this plane of the blackboard will be M2, will be the space where the sigma model, where the two-dimensional category lives. So now, I'm working for generic kappa. For generic kappa or psi, the bulk theory is really very simple. It does not even have lines. So in standard geometric Langlands, you got a lot of mileage out of Wilson line, Tuft lines, and the way they act on boundary conditions. For generic kappa, they are gone. On the other hand, sometimes they survive at the boundary. So there are boundary lines. What can you do with these boundary lines? They're lines in a three-dimensional space. So you can fuse them and you can braid them. So this is a ribbon category. A braided tensor category with a topological twist. Actually, I should really say spin ribbon. I want to be careful because if we work with manifolds with spin, we cannot really detect what happens if I torque a line by 2 pi, but only if I torque it by 4 pi. But anyway, let me ignore that for now. So each of these boundary conditions is associated to some lines. And for the boundary conditions introduced by Ed, we can ask what is the category of lines. Now, this question was answered, for example, for Neumann boundary conditions, explicitly or implicitly in the work on knot invariants and in analytic continuation of Chern-Simons theory. So Neumann boundary conditions support Kasdan-Lustig. In a very concrete sense, Neumann boundary conditions.
You earlier made this passing remark that wasn't really a ribbon category, it was a chiral category.
Yes.
Are you backing off from that?
No, actually. It's just that I don't know the language of categories well enough to be sure not to make worse mistakes that I'm doing. So, but I expect that typically it's going to be always, yeah, it, okay. For boundary conditions which come, which are compatible with an holomorphic topological twist and the formation to topological twist, I'm confident this would be a Kara category. So in the setup that Phil Sang is being employing to discuss an equal four supreme meals, the boundary conditions which are compatible with his calculations will support chiral categories, I believe. And indeed, I think that the setup of your paper can be used to derive all the statements I'll make about boundary conditions and junctions.
So the fact that topological is in quotes is because of that, or it's because?
Well, Kazan-Lustig for generic kappa is not really something that you would be happy to see in a topological field theory, right? It's not dualizable.
Two orthogonal reasons for not being happy about
okay.
Which one it was.
Not dualizable, no.
Both that and it's this issue about whether it's ribbon or kappa.
Space of conformal.
You could take it as a ribbon category. You would not do anything wrong, right? Because it's also the category of quantum group representations. So that is not a problem. The not lack of dualizability is probably more of a problem. So in a true four-dimensional topological field theory where you have everything topological and well-behaved, then this would not occur, presumably. Anyway, so. One way to understand it is discussed as Lustig is that Neumann boundary conditions, in a sense, support analytically continued Chern-Simons theory. So whenever you want to do Chern-Simons theory a generic kappa, the way you do it is you place it at you replace your 3D theory with these boundary conditions of 4D theory. Lines in Chern-Simons theory are some. Okay, Chern-Simons theory is associated to WCW models. Analytically continued Chern-Simons theory is associated to Katz-Moody's. Lines in Chern-Simons theory are in correspondence to modules for the WCW. And lines in this Neumann boundary condition are in correspondence to nice modules for WCW. In any moment, I'll make that more precise. Well, right. Now, a junction talks to two boundary conditions and two categories of lines. So you can ask what happens when these lines hit the junction. So generically, along the junction, we find some vertex algebra. And there are some OPEs which tell you how these local operators can be brought against each other. But where lines meet the junction, there are some other local operators, different from the ones that you find the generic points. But they have the property that you can still bring operators from generic points to these special points. In other words, these spaces of local operators are modules for A. A precise way to say this is that there is a functor from the lines of boundary 1 bar times line of boundary 2 into these modules for the vertex algebra.
Just to make sure I understand the semantics. So A is a vertex algebra associated to the pair B1, B2.
That's right, and junction. So the junction is extra data. You might have multiple junctions between the same pair of boundary conditions. So A, the vertex algebra A, depends on the choice of junction, boundary condition. Well, I should say the other way. Theory, boundary condition, and junction.
Junctions, what kind of structure?
It varies. It depends on how you define your boundary conditions.
But wouldn't you say if there's a two category of boundary conditions, it's a morphism between two objects?
Right. That's right. So if there is some type of a category with morphisms of vertex algebras, this would be it. So there is some kind of category-like thing where objects are chiral categories and morphisms are vertex algebras with representation of the two chiral categories into A modules.
So L of B is a category associated, it's a chiral category associated to B.
That's right.
For example, when B is Neumann, L of B is Cartesian.
That's right. Now, all of this data, both the category and the algebra, is invariant under dualities. So immediately I should say, oh, but then num, regular numpole, principle, must be the same category for the dual theory. So must be Kasdan-Lustig, must be some category which is isomorphic to Kasdan-Lustig at the minus 1 over mk. For G dual, right? This now, if you do the calculation by hand of which lines live on num, I'm told that you'll find something called the Whittaker category. And which is known to be dual to isomorphic to the Kasdan-Lustig for the dual. Finally, I'm also being told by Phil that for Dirichlet, we should have something else, which is the modules on the affine Grassmannian. Now, this sounds a very scary statement, but it's actually more comprehensible than it sounds, meaning we are trying to describe lines at Dirichlet boundary conditions, and you can convince yourself that these are toothed lines. So when you have a toothed line, right, so how do we possibly study the space of toothed lines? One way is to sort of take the theory. So if I was in the bulk, if I wanted to study the space of lines in the bulk theory, I would take the theory, look at how it behaves on a sphere surrounding the line. And then somehow this gives me a 2D system, and the category of boundary conditions for the 2D system is at least closely related to the category of lines for the original theory. For boundary lines, I'm going to look at hemisphere in the theory with the boundary at the boundary of the hemisphere. And so you have Dirichlet boundary conditions, so somehow the gauge group is trivial at the boundary. So I have a disk, a hemisphere, with a bundle, but the bundle has been trivialized at the boundary. So classically, I have a phase space, which you can argue that the phase space of the theory in the half disk is something like the cotangent bundle to the affine Grassmannian. Affine Grassmannian is sort of gauge transformations.
Just repeat the
sentence. I want to say that the space of states of the, so if I take the 4D theory on a disk with Dirichlet boundary condition, and I look at the phase space of this, at the classical, if I chose to look at the classical four-dimensional theory, and I reduce it to the on a disk like that, I get something that looks like the cotangent bundle to the affine Grassmannian.
This is a disk with what dimension?
Yes.
This is a disk with which dimension?
It's a 2D disk. It's really the picture I'm drawing. So literally, you know, I can take I'm looking at the space of bundles on a disk which are trivialized at the boundary. So the trivialization is a map from the boundary into the group, and then I quotient this map by gauge transformations which are well behaved inside, and so I do something like g of k mod g of o, which is the affine Grassmannian. And then there are more fields in the theory than just the gauge fields, and so in the same way as the space of states on a Riemann surface, the phase space on a Riemann surface is the cotangent to the space of bundles. Here I get something like the cotangent on the affine Grassmannian.
So you're doing the usual calculation for any Riemann surface.
But for a disk.
A disk with the trivialization on the boundary.
That's right. I'm sorry, I'm explaining it very poorly. And so I get something like, now quantizing the system is going to give me the modules on the fine Grassmannian, roughly. So at least that's how I understand the explanation that has been given to me about this statement. So now let's do some checks. If I take Neumann and num, I get some vertex algebra here. This vertex algebra can be computed to be the W algebra. Now, is it true that W algebra has modules labeled by two lines in Kazan-Lustig and Kazan-Lustig dual? Yes, that is a true fact. They generate, if you just want to think about Virasoro as an example, Virasoro has a category of degenerate modules, which are labeled by two integers. These two integers are very literally a spin for SU2 and a spin for a dual SU2. If you take Neumann and Dirichlet, here you get Kazmoudi at the corner. Kazmoudi definitely has a Kazan-Lustig category of modules coming from lines on along Neumann. And you can take any of these modules and twist it by an element of the fine Grassmannian. So you can find some modules which are labeled by Kazan-Lustig times the modules on the fine Grassmannian. Now, so these are the basic boundary conditions that we are available. We have these, but of course we can act with dualities on any of these. Remembering that T fixes Dirichlet and fixes num. So as a consequence, if you act with dualities on Neumann or num in the most general possible way, you can argue that you get a family labeled by two integers of Neumann-like boundary conditions, which have Kazan-Lustig for some twist and some variant of the group here. And you also have another family of the boundary conditions which arise from Dirichlet and its images. So now, what is the relation between this and the modules on Banji or other things like that? Well, there must be some map that takes a boundary condition in the 4D theory. It sends it to a boundary condition for the 2D theory by compactification on the Riemann surface. Right? And we're trying to figure out what this map is. Then if we understand how dualities act on boundary conditions and we understand this map, then we'll be able to understand how dualities act on the image in the category of the 2D theory and perhaps make contact with quantum geometric Langlands. Now, if I have a junction between B and B1 and B2, this will map up upon compactification to a junction between the compactifications of the boundaries. Now, a junction between two boundary conditions in U1D is precisely the same as a morphism from a boundary to the other. So we should be able to compute to at least find a map from junctions to morphisms between the brains. What does it mean to compactify a vertex algebra? It means to compute correlation functions, or better, conformal blocks for that vertex algebra. There is a useful way to think about this, that somehow you can turn this picture around and think about the junction as preparing a state for the theory in a segment. And this is very analogous to the statement that somehow conformal blocks of WZW are related to the space of states of Chern-Simons theory. So the strategy is to learn about the 2D image of objects by computing conformal blocks of the corresponding vertex algebras. So the conformal block of the vertex algebra has a good chance to map to, and typically we believe should be actually the same as home in the 2D category between the image of the two boundary conditions. Notice that I told you there are many different junctions, and for this to hold, to have a chance to hold, it must be that the corresponding vertex algebras all had the same conformal blocks. Right. The idea is somehow is if as long as the junction is not too trivial, the conformal blocks of the corresponding vertex algebras will be able to explore the whole of space of states. Now, inside the category of D-modules, one way to learn about the D-module is to take homes with Dirichlet with delta functions. If I take a home from a D-module to a delta function, I get the fiber of the D-module at that point. And moreover, the delta functions have some structure that allows me to move them around. So if I do things carefully, I can get back the actual D-module, although I can get all sorts of worries about singularities that I'm not sure what to say about. But this suggests that, at least suggests that perhaps to learn about the map, we should look at configurations involving a generic boundary condition and Dirichlet. Why? Because Dirichlet boundary conditions can be coupled to a bundle, and you can check essentially by construction that we compactify Dirichlet boundary condition, you get another Dirichlet boundary condition. You get something that fixes the bundle to have some value. So computing the vertex algebra from boundary condition to Dirichlet boundary condition and its conformal blocks has at least a chance to give us a description of the D-modules. Indeed, it usually happens that these vertex algebras have Kac-Moody subalgebras, so indeed give the conformal blocks are D-modules on the space of bundles. Let's check some examples. If I take Neumann, well, one example, which is really the important one, and Dirichlet, here I find Kac-Moody. What are conformal blocks of Kac-Moody? They're precisely DK, the deep module of differential operators. So this supports the idea that somehow DK is related to Neumann boundary conditions. And it's also, just in the same way as it's classical, you can reduce Dirichlet to see that you land on the delta function. You can reduce classically NumPol to see that you land on this quantum upper D-module. So these calculations I'm doing are definitely compatible with the idea that D of K is dual to the uppers, to the quantum uppers. But now, so this means that to do other calculations, I just need to find junctions between Dirichlet and other things. Right. So I should be very happy if I can find things like a junction between NPQ and Dirichlet. If I can do that, I get a vertex algebra which has a chance to tell me what the duality image is of D. And I'd be even happier if I find a junction between dual images of Dirichlet and Dirichlet. This would have a chance to give me information about the duality kernels. Because it's telling me.
The junction is a structure, right?
Yes, I need to find this junction and to do calculations with it. I need at least one. As long as I have one, I'm happy. If I find two, I'm happy and worried. It means that now I have a chance to check if the conformal blocks of the two vertex algebras are really the same. And until now, all times I managed to find multiple junctions, they gave equivalent vertex algebras. But I'm sure that there will be all sorts of subtleties when the exploration continues. But how do we possibly find something like this? See, the only definition I have of this is that it's a duality image of Dirichlet or a duality image of Neumann. How do I? That's not a concrete description. So how can I possibly get a junction between that and Dirichlet? So you can use the following trick. You need to learn how to combine simpler junctions into more complicated junctions. So let me now draw another picture which is analogous to this. But I need space. And I'm 10 minutes late, so I'm sorry, I'm the first one who's behaving badly. So let me take some boundary condition B1. Then boundary condition B2. And then boundary condition B3. And junctions J1-2, J2-3. Okay. Now, if I have a setup like this, I can imagine just squeezing the picture until I get a junction between B1 and B3. Right? So I should be able to compose junctions in this mysterious category of 3D boundary conditions. What could the local operators be in the new junction? Well, local operators of the old junctions presumably survive the process. Everything is topological away from them. But I can get new stuff. I can get a line of the boundary tree, B2, which ends on the junctions. When I squeeze the junctions together, this becomes a new local operator. So conjecturally, the vertex algebra for the composition of junctions is an extension of the product of the vertex algebra for the junctions. And it's, morally speaking, a sum over all lines of the modules associated to these lines. Now, sum over all lines should be understood properly as an algebra object in the product of the two categories. For generic kappa, for Kazan-Lustig, this is just literally a sum over modules. But for general boundary conditions, I'm sure that it can get much more complicated.
When you say lines, is the lines where?
So these are lines along the intermediate boundary. So they're labeled by the category of lines, so the intermediate boundary. They stretch along this boundary segment in between the two junctions. So that's my prescription for how to compose vertex algebras in this category. It's an associative prescription at the very least. It produces nice new modules because now if you look at things that look like that, you can check that these are good modules for this algebra. So at least it seems sensible. And it gives rise to the vertex algebra constructions I sketched earlier in the talk. Now, the trick is that if I want to describe something like that, what I can do is to resolve the junction into a sequence of junctions. I start from NPQ, and then I have NP1, Q1, and then NP2, Q2, etc., all the way to Dirichlet. When do I win? I win if each pair of band, if consecutive pair, has a simultaneously weakly coupled description. Essentially, if I can find the duality frame where each of these pairs is a Nam and Neumann pair. Because then my algebra is going to be a composition of the type W times W times W, W with a Kac-Moody at the end. And similarly here, I get Kac-Moody times W times W times W all the way to Kac-Moody. So there is a good chance that these are junction vertex algebras. And then the conformal blocks should give me informations about homes between the image of these and the delta function. By construction, these vertex algebras have a Kac-Moody subalgebra, so you can couple them to bundles. Chiral cohomology to these extensions is going to be some demodule on the space of bundles. It's not even a very complicated demodule in the sense that, at least among conformal blocks, I mean, a conformal block is just a collection of correlation functions which satisfy OPE. So a conformal block for the big algebra is in particular a product conformal, lives in particular in the product conformal blocks for the smaller algebras. And what is it? It's those conformal blocks for which these extra modules are single valued. So there is some algebraic operation that you can do in the product of conformal blocks to find the conformal blocks of this. It's some kind of global sections on a RAN space, I think, in the language I've heard. But
global sections on the what space?
On the space of configuration of points on the surface. Essentially, you just write a huge amount of Knitting subalogic of equations, and you try to find solutions which are single valued in there. Okay. So this is all I have to say.
I suspect you have more to say.
Well, this is the thing I'm. Well, what I can do is, to, of course, whoever is interested, I can write down, thanks to the help of other collaborators, concrete examples for these vertex algebras. For example, for SL2, you can write the kernel vertex algebra explicitly and try to use it to produce the modules of various sorts.
Is there an example where if you can illustrate the consequences for conformal blocks that that this implies, that the vertex algebra dualities implied by the S-duality would apply?
Well, let me see. So let me give a simple example. I will walk with GLN because otherwise things get more subtle. So we know that there is a W algebra, there is a Kac-Moody between N10, which is Neumann, sorry, and Dirichlet. So there is a standard junction which has Kac-Moody. Now, let me try to build another junction and see if I find again a vertex algebra with the same conformal blocks as Kac-Moody. What can I do? I can go from N10 to N1 minus 1 to Dirichlet. So here I have now a W algebra, and here I have a new Kac-Moody. I mean, it's a Kac-Moody for the same group, but for a different level. So I have some extension of W algebra times, and actually the level of this Kac-Moody is just kappa plus 1. Kappa So I'm going to say tight. Yeah, kappa plus 1. So minus 1. Kappa plus 1, sorry. So I have now W algebra times that's Moody at level kappa plus 1. Now, it turns out that the level of this W algebra is precisely the one that would allow you to write down a coset description. So W algebras are usually described as Drinsky Solokov reduction. But in many situations, you can also give a coset description. You take Kac-Moody times a bunch of fermions, or a level 1 WZW divided by Kac-Moody. As I said, this extension is a reverse coset. So in this situation, all you get is just V at level kappa times WZW at level 1. And I was working with UN, so this WZW at level 1 is just a bunch of complex fermions. Complex fermions have trivial conformal blocks, a one-dimensional space of conformal blocks, which is trivial. Trivial is actually the line bundle I was discussing. And after a bit of extra work, convince yourself. I mean, so this is essentially equivalent to this. That's what I'm trying to say. I mean, the map from conformal blocks to the modules involves multiplying by the powers of L that you need to land on the right place. So this really gives the same answer as this. And it does it thanks to a very non-trivial statement about W algebras.
So, which algebras are you comparing? So you're saying that there are two algebras which have the same conformal blocks. So one is just the Kac-Moody algebra. Right?
And the other is Kac-Moody times a bunch of complex fermions.
So where did you get? I mean, I thought that your first junction just involved Kac-Moody, no, there were no fermions.
Yes, that's right. So they're different vertex algebras, but they're the same conformal blocks.
Right. So I'm just trying to say. What are the two algebras? The first is just Kac-Moody algebra.
That's right.
And the second, is it just Kac-Moody times W algebra for certain levels, or is it something?
No, it's an extension of W algebra times Kac-Moody.
And which extension?
It's the extension which is Kac-Moody times fermions. So it's an extension of this.
But the extension is made in the way you said, by pairing various modules.
That's right. By pairing modules. So let me take tensor product over Kac-Lustig. Let me denote the extension like that. So this extension is literally Kac-Moody times a complex fermion.
What happened to the W algebra?
The W algebra is a coset. I just cancel the denominator against this. The multiplication of fractions.
In a sense, you answered my question on the level of chiral algebras.
Yes.
On the level of conformal blocks, of course, it should imply something rather remarkable, right? That something like bilinear combinations of sums of conformal blocks where sum over representations are equal to the conformal blocks of another
yes.
algebra.
Yes, but that is precisely the coset, I think. So, well, okay, no, I take it back. So there is a question, how do I compute the conformal blocks of a coset, for example? Now, the coset itself can be given a BRST definition. So if I have A divided by Kac-Moody, I can write this as A times Kac-Moody of the opposite level reduced by a BRST charge, which is something like the contour integral. I mean, I add ghosts also, and then contour integral of CJ total. Plus dot, dot, dot. So it's definitely true that I can embed, so in particular, you know, the each operator here is some BRST cohomology in here. So it's not obvious to me that every conformal block in here can be obtained from this construction. But if you do this construction at the level of conformal blocks, this is literally taking the home from the conformal blocks of this and D. So it's a natural operation on the modules. I do not know if this always gives you the right answer.
Question, please.
So can I compute conformal blocks of this BRST reduction starting from conformal blocks of A and doing some simple manipulation on band G?
So the naive conjecture would be that conformal blocks, which is a vector space, is a home.
That's right.
Band G from D, which is conformal blocks of.
That's what this?
Yeah.
That's right.
To the localization of A, which is another D module on band G.
That's right.
That's the conjecture.
That's the conjecture. Is it true in general or for special A's? It better be true for the A's that I'm using.
It seems clear there's a speckled sequence. Just by filtering by the number of C's, you get some.
Right.
Like what he said.
So I did not realize this in the past, definitely, that I could compute conformal blocks of W algebra by very concretely. You know, correlation functions of W algebras can be written literally as an integral over the space of bundles of conformal blocks of, you know, Katz-Moody. So if I use, sorry, conformal blocks of a coset should be writable explicitly as an integral over band G of conformal blocks of this other vertex algebra times partition function of the ghosts and conformal blocks of this, correlation function of this. Already for the sphere, this gives some pretty nice formula that I mean, I've been discussing with Frankel. It seemed to be some related to some formula that he had been writing down with Okunkov and Aganagic. But anyway, so there's another statement is, what are conformal blocks of a Drinfield-Solokov reduction? If I compute them within the Drinfield-Solokov reduction, they look like taking homes with this Hopper or Whittaker D-module. But it's not obvious that this will capture all the conformal blocks of the Drinfield-Solokov reduction. Is it always true?
That is true.
It says true always? X.
Specifically for the W algebra?
Okay, but for a generic, I mean, which condition must hold on the vertex algebra for this to be true in general?
In delegated discussion session, I guess.
Yes, sorry.
So I have one question. I don't know if you want to answer it now or later. So I'm trying to wrap my head around this idea of juncture.
Yes.
So you have two brains.
Yes.
Junctures form, I guess, a category, right?
Yes, in 2D, 1D, yes.
Okay, maybe the question is a little before. So you're supposed to have a two category associated to a circle.
Yes.
How is that related to the category of brains?
Right. So suppose I compactify things on a circle instead of C. Then these objects would map to some object in this two category. And A mod, the compactification of A on a circle, I think, is just A modules. So A modules should be the home category between these object and this object.
So again, just B correspond to objects in that two category?
That's right. Some objects, at least, are of that form.
Yes. And again, the category of junctures between them is, again, what? Oh, it's just the category of homes?
That's right. It maps, at least, to the category of homes upon compactification. So if you give me a junction, I get a vertex algebra, then I can look at modules for that vertex algebra. And there's a chance to be the home between the two objects. Now, when you start looking at circle compactification,
so you think that any module over this vertex algebra should give you a home?
I would think so. By the way, if you start thinking about two categories, you should put other ingredients in which I've not mentioned and I've not studied much, but are definitely fun, which are surface defects that were mentioned before. So if you take Gukov-Witten defects or other surface defects, those can also give you a boundary condition for the theory in a circle. So there are two ways to make boundary conditions for a theory in a circle. You can put a 3D boundary condition compactified, or you can put HOD defect at the tip of a cigar. So local geometric Langlands, which is about the story of these two categories, combine statements about boundary conditions, compatible in the circle, and surface defects in some rich way. So in gauge theory, see, once you have a surface defect, you can put it like that. Now you have lines where the surface defect meets the boundaries and extra modules for the vertex algebra. And I think it will be very interesting to explore this structure.
Mm-hmm. In your imagination, sigma is supporting a what type of defect? A topological defect, a conformal defect?
A topological defect. So Gukov-Witten defects are supposed to be topological.
Oh, but that's sigma's a three.
It's a two-dimensional object. It's a topological two-dimensional object. So as I said, there are few two-dimensional objects. There are very few 2D junctions, but there are actually a lot of 2D topological bulk objects. So there are a lot of junctions between the identity interface in itself. There might actually also be a lot of topological junctions between the brain and itself. I've not looked at it.
That sigma looks like it's ending at a point on C.
That's right. So it gives you a new module.
So module.
There should be a category of A modules, which is labeled by sigma. For every pair of boundary conditions. For example, I think for Gukov-Witten defects and in this setup, you would get general modules of W algebra instead of degenerate modules. And I think here you would get general modules, wild modules, but associated to generic representation of the Lie algebra rather than finite dimensional ones. But again, this is very conjectural, and I only have one example, so it's not. So that's definitely a very fun direction to explore.
Last question. So I guess the answer would be negative. So is it correct that it's not explicitly known what is the Langlands dual of Dirichlet?
Well, if you use this prescription. Oh, no, so Langland dual, sorry. I understood the question wrong. Yes. Well, it's T of G coupled to the 4D theory. But there are two problems with this statement. So the first is T of G is a superconformal, strongly coupled superconformal field theory. We know gauge theories which flow under RG flow to this, sometimes, not always, but they don't have all the symmetries that T of G needs to have. And furthermore, if you want to work a generic kappa, T of G has to be further deformed, because the Neumann plus T of G preserves the boundary, preserves supersymmetry appropriate for kappa equal to infinity, and you want something for generic kappa. So you need a deformation of T of G. It's hard. So this trick of resolving the junctions is trying to sidestep the problem. Now, let me mention something that is still fun. You can take these vertex algebras and take the kappa to infinity limit. Okay? Then they can be computed from the undeformed T of G. And you can try to do the calculation in gauge theory. And it actually works. So for SU2, you can take this theory of U1 coupled to two hypers, compute a vertex algebra out of it. It gives you PSU 2/2 at level 1, if you're interested. And then you can compare this with the calculation done by resolving the junctions, which is completely different, and which gives you something else called D2/1 minus kappa at level 1. And then magically, the kappa to infinity limit of this vertex algebra gives you this. That's a very nice check. of the whole picture, which really not obvious. So in general, So as I said, this construction works. The construction of the vertex algebras works ideally for generic K. But once you construct them, they're just vertex algebras with some OPs, which depends on kappa as some rational functions of kappa. Usually there is no problem, or it's at least doable, to take specific limits of kappa to rational values and explore places which would be difficult to explore otherwise. And funnily enough, when you do this limit, you automatically equip this vertex algebra with what you need to couple it to flat connections instead of bundles. So this vertex algebra has two Kac-Moody subalgebras. This one has one Kac-Moody subalgebra and has one global symmetry, together with some extra equipment that allows you to couple the algebra to a flat connection. And so it really gives you something that lives on coherent sheaves on the flat connections. Okay.